Part of our passage this morning is known as the Shema. Shema is a Hebrew word, which means hear. And it's probably the most important or well-known passage in the Hebrew Bible for the Jewish people. Shema Israel, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Ehud. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Before we get more into that, though, let me recap a little bit. We are on this 10-month journey through the Bible together, and we have made it out of the book of Genesis. It took us a while because there's a lot in there. We did the primeval history, which is those stories that almost feel like myths or legends, the story of creation in 7 days and Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and Noah and the flood. And then we got to the stories of the ancestral history in which God makes a covenant with a specific people, with Abraham and Sarah and their descendants, Isaac and Jacob. Jacob, of course, has 12 sons, one of which is Joseph, and Joseph goes to Egypt. He's sold into slavery there, and then ultimately the rest of his family joins him there because there is a famine. And that is how the Hebrew people end up enslaved in Egypt. Last Sunday, we turned to the story of Moses and God leading the people out of Egypt. John Jackson, just about every week, has told me a joke based on our character. So the one he told me last week is, did you know that Moses is the greatest obstetrician? Right? He delivered the children of Israel. Right? That's a John Jackson joke for you. So I trust you to keep bringing those, and I'll share them in worship sometime. So, all right. So last week we heard about the deliverance out of Egypt, the Exodus, and the army chased them, and they crossed the Red Sea, and all those kinds of things. So they are now free. But where we're going is that eventually they'll wander through the wilderness and end up in the Promised Land. And it takes a while to conquer the Promised Land. There's all this things that have to happen, and then we'll go through the period of the judges, and then Saul first, and then David will become king and unite all of the tribes of Israel together. And then all kinds of fun stuff happens and some not so fun stuff, and we'll get to all that. But today, I want us to turn to this idea of the law. The people of Israel, the children of Israel, have come out of Egypt and they stop at a mountain. And it's the same mountain that Moses had his calling experience at, but it's called by different names. So one of the names is Mount Sinai, which is the one that I think we are most familiar with. But it's also known as Mount Horeb, Horeb, H-O-R-E-B. And so this is kind of an interesting thing about the Bible, is that it uses different words for the same thing. And scholars think that it's because it was written by different people over different periods of time, right? So in Deuteronomy in particular, it uses Mount Sinai to refer to this mountain. In Exodus, the story that we heard last week, it's referred to as Mount Horeb. Deuteronomy and Exodus were probably written by different people. And so one of the interesting rabbit trails to go down in biblical scholarship is to kind of tease out, well, which parts of the Bible were written by which people or which groups of people and all that kind of stuff. For example, they'd use different words for the name of God, right? So Yahweh is the one, which means I am, is one that we often hear. And so they think, well, there was a person or group of people who used that name when they wrote about God. And then God, Elohim in Hebrew, is another word that they use. And so, well, there's this other person or other group that writes using that. And so they kind of tease out, well, who did this and how it all fits together. And so anyway, I'm happy to tell you more about that when you want, but let's get past that. All right, so they get to the mountain, right? And the story that we're hearing is from the book of Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy is actually like this big address that Moses gives to the people before they enter into the Promised Land. It's Moses looking back and recounting the story of them. And then Exodus is more written like as the story's unfolding. Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers kind of do that. So this is Deuteronomy, Moses looking back and telling the story of what happened. So they arrive at this mountain, and God speaks to Moses and tells Moses to come up onto the mountain, but the people have to stay down below. And this cloud descends upon the mountain, and the mountain is covered in cloud, it's covered in smoke, and there's terrible thunder and all these kinds of things. And Moses has to walk into the presence of God and receive the commandments from God, the Torah. Now, Torah is an interesting word. It's one of those words that doesn't quite translate into English very well. Kind of think about aloha in Hawaiian, right? It has all these different meanings. It's kind of bigger than any word, single word that we have in English. Torah is the same way. It can mean law, it can mean commandment, it can mean instruction or teaching. It can refer to a specific law that's given or to the broader sense of the collection of the law itself. It's even used to refer to these first five books of the Bible are collectively known as the Torah. So there's that. One of the things to remember about the Torah is to think of it as a gift and not a burden. In the New Testament, in particular, law gets contrasted with gospel quite a bit, especially in Paul's letters. It talks about law and gospel, and obviously Paul lifts up gospel as better than the law, that it's just better. But I think that is a kind of misunderstanding of what Torah really is, that Torah is designed for our benefit. It's to help us live and to know what to do and how to be and how to operate in the world, how to relate to God and how to relate to one another. Many of the laws are given for our explicit benefit. If you think about some of the dietary laws that are given, not eating pork, not eating shellfish, all those kinds of things, there are health implications to those, right? Those protein sources in particular, if they are undercooked, can really get a person sick. And so at least some of the thought is, well, that's part of why they were considered unclean, because it was easy to get sick from them. And so let's just avoid those altogether so that we stay healthy. All kinds of laws about cleanliness and all kinds of other things as well. So they're given for our benefit. The law is a gift. And so if we start to look at it from that lens, from that perspective, I think it sheds a new light. It's not something that's oppressive to us, even though that's often how it's kind of portrayed in the New Testament. It truly is a gift. Another thing about the law is that it's given in the context of a covenant. We talked about covenant a few weeks ago with Abraham. And again, a covenant is a special relationship that two parties enter into, almost like a contract, but more personal and intimate than that. And so God made covenant with this specific group of people. And kind of the basic outline of the covenant is that I will be your God and you will be my people. And so part of how that works is that they need some kind of understanding back and forth in how to relate to one another. And so part of it is that God gives these laws as how they are to operate and live in the world. We sang just a moment ago, trust and obey. As a parent, I'm beginning to understand more and more the importance of obey, right? And how it really is an expression of love when children obey their parents, right? Because the instructions that I give my kids, it's because I care about them and I want them to be healthy and to be safe and to grow into productive and kind and good human beings, right? And so when they do the things I say, yay, we're headed on that path. But when they don't do those things, well, we're heading in a different direction, and that's not good, right? And so it's really kind of the same way with God and the children of Israel, giving these instructions. And so as they and we follow those instructions, it's how they keep the covenant. God is always faithful, as Steffi talked about in the children's message. God is always faithful, and so the way that we can be faithful is to be obedient to these laws that are given. And then the last thing is to think about them more in the big picture. It's easy to get lost in the details of these laws. There's hundreds of them, and I think people like to kind of nitpick about specific ones and things. But to me, it's more important to think about the big picture behind these. That behind them all are certain ethics about how we are to live and how we are to be in the world. And so when we step back from the particular laws and look at kind of the reasoning behind them and the heart that is behind them, I think that is most helpful to us, especially as we are living thousands of years later when some of these kind of situations just don't even apply anymore. We can still look at the reasoning and the ethic behind them and try to apply that to our lives here today. So I want to take a closer look at some of these laws and see what they have for us today. This summer, we did a whole series on the Ten Commandments. That would be an easy place to start, but I don't want to dig into those too much because we already did that this summer. But I do want to lift up one thing that's particular about the Ten Commandments is that there are four commandments that focus on what it means to love God, that God is first in our life, that we don't have any idols, that we don't take the Lord's name in vain, and that we honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. All of those are about our relationship with God and how we love God and worship God. And then there are six commandments that talk about how we are to interact with one another in the world. Don't lie, don't steal, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't covet. There's one other I'm forgetting, but wish it would come to mind, but it's not. Anyway, yes, honor your father and mother. Thank you very much. I was just talking about obedience, right? Yeah. Good job, Travis. All right. So these Ten Commandments really can be broken down into two. And this is essentially what Jesus says in the New Testament, right? That all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments: to love God with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind, and all our strength, and to love our neighbor as ourself. And so it's through that lens in particular that Jesus gives us and reminds us of that I want to look at the laws in general. Okay? So there are four categories of law, and the first one that I want us to look at is laws about worship. All right, there's a few up there on the screen. Hopefully you can read those. I'm not going to read them out loud. But there are many, many, many laws about how we are to worship God. So there's specific laws that talk about the festivals that were to be celebrated, festivals that remembered specific events in the life and history of the people of Israel. There are all these prescriptions about how sacrifices are to be made and what the priests are to do and to say and how they're supposed to set up the temple and all this kind of stuff. There's laws about the sacrifices and tithing and all those different things. And so part of the law is to tell us how we are to love God in particular through worship. And we can recognize, I think, that worshiping is important. That it's important for us to acknowledge and to stay in relationship with the one who has created us and who still cares for us and who calls us and provides for us. A time to pause in our week, to give thanks for all the blessings that we enjoy, to spend time in fellowship with the one who made us. And so many of these laws govern what it means to worship. Now, some of those laws don't apply anymore, like the specifics, right? We don't have a temple that we go to. We have a church, but it's, you know, pretty different. We don't make animal sacrifices anymore. So it's more about taking the understanding behind those laws and how we live those here in the world today, how we worship in a modern kind of context. All right, the next category of law is purity. Everybody's favorite, right? So the idea behind purity laws are that the people of God are to be set apart from the rest of the world, that there is something that is distinctive about being in covenant with God that makes that community different than the other cultures and the other societies and the other people of the world. Now, we often get caught up in the details of these, right? But one of the things about them is that they are thousands of years old. And so our society today is way different than the society was way back then. And so to try to take the laws from 2,000-3,000 years ago and make them, you know, the very letter of the law work today when the situation is much, much different, I think in most circumstances just doesn't work. Right? Well, it's one that's up there. Yeah, shave your forelocks for the dead. Anybody ever heard of anybody doing that? No, that's not a thing people do today anymore, right? But back in that time, some of the cultures that lived in the Promised Land, they did that. And so for the people of Israel to be set apart from them, they weren't supposed to do that, right? And so I don't want to name like specific things today, but for us to think about what it means for us as people who are part of the new covenant, as people who trust in Jesus Christ, to be set apart from the rest of the world. What does it mean for us to be pure, for us to be holy? I invite you to chew on that for a while and think about that. One of the other things about these purity laws is that they really help to define the community itself, right? So circumcision was part of this, right? And so that was the sign of the covenant. And so for you to be part of the family of God, the people of God, that was part of what had to happen, right? So what are some of the signs and symbols and things that we do to say who is part of this community? Baptism is, of course, an important thing for us as Christians. And then sharing around this table at communion as well. Receiving the gift of Christ's body and blood is another. All right, so we got purity laws. And then up next are social laws. So there are lots of laws in the Hebrew Bible about how society is to be governed. So there's laws about what kings are supposed to do and limits on their powers, about judges and how they're supposed to judge between things, and lots of different laws, just kind of general ones that we would think of today, like don't murder, don't steal, all those kinds of things. Many of these laws or forms of them get passed down to us today and are part of our society that legislatures pass, right? So part of the purpose of the law is to help structure society in a way that works for the people. So hopefully that makes sense. And then the last category of law is justice. Laws about justice. In particular, these laws are aimed at protecting those who are most vulnerable in society. So it limits the power of certain people, and it commands us to care for those who are disenfranchised, who are marginalized, who might be oppressed, who don't have enough or the ability in life to make for themselves. So in the Hebrew Bible in particular, it lifts up widows, orphans, and strangers, or aliens, or immigrants, whatever translation you want to use. So who are the people in our society today who are vulnerable, who are marginalized? And how do we structure our lives and our society and our church and everything else in order to care for them? Part of this, too, is about fairness, right? I think there's one up there about having different weights or different scales, right? So that you treat everybody the same, regardless of their background. You don't try to take advantage of somebody because of their education or their gender or whatever it might be. You treat everybody the same. It's a principle behind these laws. All right, so just to recap, there are kind of four categories of laws: worship laws, purity laws, laws about society and how the social order is to work, and then laws about justice. And so you might ask yourself, which of these are most important? And I think the answer is they're all important, right? But I think our human tendency is, at least on individual levels and even on larger levels, communities tend to gravitate towards certain ones of these, right? And I think that that creates a lot of conflict in our life and in the world. So in particular, in the church these days, I think there's a great struggle behind the laws relating to purity and the laws relating to justice, right? That there are those who think that laws about purity and are most important, and that that's what we need to lift up in order for us to be good and holy and righteous people. But then there are those who say, no, these laws about justice are most important. It matters more that we care for those who are disenfranchised, that we care for those who've been oppressed, that we provide for those who are in need. And so there is this conflict between these groups who think in these kinds of ways. And I don't know how to fix that, other than to say that both are important. And it's important for us not to take the letter of the law and try to apply it today, but to take the principles behind both of these areas of law and apply them today. And so I don't know that we literally need to go out and start ministries for widows, orphans, and immigrants. Maybe that's part of it. But there are certainly lots of other people who are oppressed and marginalized that we need to care for and provide for. And I don't know that we can take all these laws about purity from the Hebrew Bible and try to make them work today, because our society is so different. The world has changed in so many ways, and our understanding of humanity and who we are and how we are created and how we live in the world is so much different. We have gained so much knowledge and understanding. There's still a lot more to go. But we know our world and our people in a much different way. And so I don't think we can ignore the idea of purity and holiness. I think we are called to be separate, to be set apart, at least from the world, to be different, that people should look upon our lives and be able to tell that we follow Christ, that there is something different about us than other people in the world. But I don't think we have to follow all those, the letter of the law and all those things from the Hebrew Bible. And so I think it is possible to hold these two in tension, to hold all four in tension, actually, and to live lives that honor all of these principles from the law. I want to close with this last passage from the passage we read from Deuteronomy, and look in particular at the words that are highlighted, because these are the instructions about the law that are given to the Hebrew people, to keep these words in their hearts, to recite them, to talk about them, to bind them to themselves, to fix them to their bodies, and to write them on the doorposts of their homes. In other words, the law should be our constant companion. It should be on our mind and in our heart all the time. And so, no, we don't need to memorize these hundreds of laws from the Hebrew Bible, but I think we do need to know the two that Jesus lifts up, the two that are embodied in the Ten Commandments, to love God with all that we are and to love our neighbor as ourself. We should remind each other of this all the time. It should govern every decision that we make. It should rule in our hearts and our lives. As we go out into the world and we live our lives, may these be in our mind. May these be on our mouths. May these be in our heart. May we live faithfully as God is faithful to us, to the law. May we love God, and may we love one another. Amen.